The Adyen Advisory Board consists of prominent members of the bioscience and tech transfer communities who help guide and promote Adyen in its mission to make research easier. Adyen is excited to announce that we've added John G. Dench, PhD, to the advisory board. John Dench is Associate Director of the Genetic Perturbation Platform at the Broad Institute and has worked with many Adgenes to help improve the understanding, curation, and explanation of our CRISPR resources. We recently sat down with Dr. Dench for an interview to help further introduce him to the Adgene community. How did you get interested in research?
So I took a microbiology class my sophomore year, and it was the first time that I was in a lab class where we had an assignment that was open-ended. It was like actually something bordering on research rather than like, here's the protocol, get a result, and hope it's close to the right answer.
Yeah.
Because if it's not, well, your grade's lower. Like, it was like, go, you know, come up with a question and answer it. And I just, oh my God, I love this. I mean, especially in college, when you are waking up on a Saturday at 7 a.m. to, like, go check your plates and you're excited to do so, you know that's...
The thing for you.
That's the thing for you.
Yeah.
How did you start working on RNAi?
I applied to graduate school, mostly in biology. And I remember when I came to MIT to interview, part of the interview process was several short talks by current faculty members. And it just blew me away. And, like... I knew that was another one that was like, oh my God, I have to come here.
Sure.
I need to spend time here. This is an incredible place.
Yeah.
And you know what? And that's when I first heard of RNAi, because Phil Sharp happened to be one of the professors giving a lecture. And what I loved about it was just this complete black box. I mean, the RNAi process had just been discovered. The mechanism was barely understood. And I ended up joining his lab when I came to MIT. And what particularly...
Did you do, like, rotations?
Yeah, I did several rotations, including one in his lab. And I was like, oh, my God, I need to do this. I think what particularly appealed to me about it was, you know, I arrived at graduate school, and many of my classmates, you know, had been bio majors. They had taken 30 of their 32 undergraduate classes were in biology. So they're like... not only knew the order of the cell cycle, which I was still sketchy on, but they knew, like, what were all the kinases involved in every single checkpoint. And I was like, I don't know what it is. But with RNAi, it's like, no one knew anything.
Yeah.
So you could, like, you read four papers, you were, like, the world's expert on it.
Yeah.
So I like that it was new.
Yeah.
I like that, you know, I can really contribute without having to have a massive knowledge base necessarily behind me, but more just... you know, figure out what are some good experiments to do and do them and learn something new.
Yeah.
What was your graduate project in Phil Sharp's lab?
So I was particularly interested in microRNAs and how they regulate their targets. So the question of both mechanism and specificity, I ended up working more on specificity. And a friend of mine worked more on mechanism, but we worked pretty closely on it. You know, the idea of, well, okay, so you have this RNA, how does it find its targets, and how much information is it using to regulate its targets, and are these things specific or are they not specific? And I think that, you know, I was studying for the purposes of microRNA biology, but it actually was work that remained relevant to this day.
Right.
Because, you know, when you do RNAi screens, there's what you're intending to do with the short hairpin RNA, but then there's the fact that it can also go into the microRNA pathway and cause all sorts of problems. And I think for a long time that was wildly underappreciated by people doing RNAi screens. And it's sort of only now people are realizing, oh, these off-target effects are quite sizable and we need to take them into account when analyzing screens.
Yeah.
What did you work on after graduate school?
Then I went on a postdoc at Harvard Med. And there, you know, I was more interested. I'd seen that comprehensive screening with RNAi was going to be very powerful if done right. So I wanted to be in an environment that was doing that.
Or did you want to do screening in any particular field or just be able to use the tool?
So the field I ended up going into was cancer biology because it seemed the most tractable at the time. I mean, it was still, you know, it's a question of model systems. So with cancer, there's obviously cells can grow. You can grow lots of cells. You can actually do screens of them. So I thought that that cancer bio was an area in which one could pretty quickly start doing screens.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I was. I was in Ed Harlow's group at Harvard Med.
How did you end up at the Broad?
I had obviously heard of the Broad from being at MIT as this place was getting started.
Yeah.
And, you know, the model that the Broad was building that had platforms with a capital P focused on technology was really critical. I think has been critical to the Broad's success over the last 11 years, and it certainly was critical for drawing me towards the Broad. The idea that, you know, in order to ask interesting biological questions, you need a tremendous amount of technology development alongside it.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was a group here led by Dave Root called the RNAi Platform at the time, and I had actually worked with Dave during my graduate work, not closely, but we had interacted a couple of times on some RNAi stuff, so, you know, we knew of each other.
Yeah.
And so this seemed like a good fit for me. What makes it a platform is that you develop technology in true collaboration with people asking biological questions.
Mm-hmm.
So we work very closely with researchers in the cancer program or medical and population genetics or, you know, people who do have a biological question, so that we're not just developing technology for its own sake, but that when people want to actually conduct genetic screens, we do it in partnership with them. So in that way, I've gotten to be a part of many different biological stories. I get to engage while we're planning a project, so a lot of intellectual input at the outset. You know, that moment of discovery of, well, what are the genes involved in this process? On some level, it's selfish. I get to see it before they do. but that's always, I mean, that's just such an exciting moment in science when you've spent, you know, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months designing an experiment and then getting the result, that first glimpse at what the data look like. That's you know. And when it looks good, I mean, that's a high that can last for several days.
Sure, definitely.
Does your background in history impact your work now?
Yeah, actually, so the CRISPR revolution, I'm sure my thoughts in it have been somewhat informed by history.
Okay.
Just to the extent that, you know, everything we're seeing with CRISPR, we saw 15 years ago with RNAi.
Sure.
In terms of the excitement over technology, in terms of how we're thinking about it from a treating disease standpoint to an intellectual property standpoint and everything in between. So
do you feel like the...
I try not to get caught up in hype.
Okay.
And I try to really focus on, well, let's do some experiments. Let's try to figure out empirically what's going on. And then we'll either spend more time with the technology or spend less time with the technology, but really until you get empirical results, don't believe the hype. Now, in the case of CRISPR, the hype was completely justified. I mean, I've been, as soon as I saw, you know, the first applications of it, I'm like, oh my God, we have to start trying this. And it has been just an incredibly useful technology. There's no doubt about that. But I think just personality wise, I tend to be a little more curmudgeonly might be one way of putting it. Cautious might be another.
Skeptical.
We'll see.
What's your favorite application of CRISPR?
Well, certainly for now it's genetic screens. I mean, so everything that one could do with RNAi in terms of determining what genes are involved in biological process X, you can do with CRISPR technology. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, the off-target effects of RNAi are pretty large. And so that can make figuring out like what's real and what's not difficult and long.
Yeah.
But with CRISPR, just the results are so much cleaner the time frame from doing your primary screen to knowing what are the real hits is so much shorter. So that's a current application of CRISPR is, okay, it's a great screening technology.
Yeah.
I think that where one can certainly think about going with CRISPR is to make better models, obviously, to engineer in specific edits so you can really know what you're studying. You know, if One thing the Broad has a lot of is variant nucleotides, where we sequence the hell out of out of normal humans, and you do GWAS studies, or you sequence tumor samples and find mutations in tumors. But we, you know, we don't really know what they're doing, and so obviously being able to engineer in that particular change and observe the effect on a cell is critical.
Yeah.
So there you can do the gene editing application, you know, one at a time. But it's not even remotely a high-throughput process right now. So I think that going forward, being able to do CRISPR, not just to analyze your 10 favorite variants over the span of a couple months, but to be able to analyze thousands of variants in a relatively short time frame is going to be incredibly meaningful.
What's needed for high-throughput CRISPR genome editing screens to become feasible?
You know, I think there's definitely an aspect of technology to the extent of the efficiency of the CRISPR system. You know, right now, if you do gene editing experiments sort of out of the box, you'll be getting less than 1% of your alleles modified. So that's clearly not beneficial to most applications because you want to study the one cell that has your edit versus the 99% that don't. You're already starting to see some progress in that regard. You know, there's people have been treating cells with small molecules. People have been delivering the CRISPR components in different ways. People have been modifying the CRISPR components in different ways. And that certainly helps. I mean, you know, every incremental step brings you closer and closer to getting high throughput about it.
Yeah.
But then I also think that, you know, the detection methods one would use downstream that have nothing to do with how you introduce the edit, but everything to do with how you read it out are going to be critical. So whether that's single-cell RNA sequencing or microfluidics to find the cells that had the edit and then you analyze the cells, the merging of all of those technologies is going to come together in order to really process through lots and lots of variants.
How did you first become involved with the AdGene?
So I've known of AdGene basically since the beginning. I mean, I remember, you guys started in 2004, I think?
Yep.
I mean, I finished grad school in 2005, and definitely in grad school, I remember searching the AdGene site for a plasmid. Uh-huh. So however you guys got on my radar in the early days, you got there.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously I've been using AdGene ever since. For its intended purpose, you know, find plasmids, share plasmids. And I think there's, in addition to that, there's a real, I'm very much in line with your overall mission of making science easier and more transparent. I mean, that's largely my job here, too, is to develop technology to make science easier for everyone and not just to make science easier for people the Broad, but to make science easier for people everywhere. I mean, that is the mission of the Broad. So the nonprofit, open, sharing ethic that AdGene has behind it is something that very much resonates with me.
What do you see as AdGene's role in the future?
The more important role that AdGene provides is a central resource for, well, what is worth having? I mean, the work that your outreach scientists do to comb through the literature, to go and talk to the people who actually have these plasmids, figure out what they do, what they might be able to do, and to organize it and catalog it. I mean, that's the critical function, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, gene synthesis has nothing to do with that. If anything, the ubiquity of gene synthesis just means that there's going to be more and more and more and more stuff available, but you know, it's like, I mean, on some level, it's fulfilling the role of Google in the internet, right? I mean, you need to find what's relevant, and that's what makes Google so valuable. It finds what is the relevant stuff in the internet, even as the long tail of garbage pages just expands, you know, exponentially.
Yeah.
So AdGene's role as a central repository for what is useful and what was used once and could be used again is absolutely critical to their success.
For more information about Dr. Dench, the Broad Institute, or AdGene's CRISPR resources, check out the resources section at the end of this post. You can also give Dr. Dench your own welcome in the comments section below. Thank you for listening to this interview and supporting AdGene. To keep up to date on all things AdGene, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and subscribe to our blog. Agene, a better way to share science.